This Torah class is brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.
Good evening. I'm sorry about the mix-up. Those mix-up at the time. Al Kopanim. I guess the topic is a sore topic in many ways. Every time some scandal breaks loose and everybody says it's terrible and so on and so forth. And the question really is there any reason why somebody who's Shomer and Zohar and many mitzvahs and with Mesiras Nefesh has a problem with this more than anything else? Chazal do say a certain hierarchy of Lashon Hara is Kulam, and the Gemara says Avak Lashon Hara, Gzela is Ruban, Arayis is Mi'utan. So it's not exactly measured with which is the strongest taiva. One would assume that Arayis is the strongest taiva, and yet it's only Mi'utan. Is it the pshat people don't think it's very usser? What exactly are the factors involved? And it's something that sort of hounds us. The more successful we become, the more of an issue becomes. So I'd like to explore two points. One more in terms of, I guess, a fundamental process, and one in terms of a more practical reason for it. Because I don't think, you know, sometimes people, when I was growing up, people didn't know about chatness. People just know it was usher. Nobody knew. And even the people who knew thought it was just like a chumra of sorts. So that's why they were kind of not zohar. So you needed somebody to get up and to say, Rabbi said there's an issur of shatness, and it's terrible, and you're supposed to not piskav, and so on and so forth. Hard to say that anyone has those feelings about gneva or gzela, whatever it is. That's hard to say that. So a fiery schmooze on the topic of how terrible gneva is, it's always good to be reminded, but I still don't think that that's the core problem, why we have an issue with it. And I'd like to speak about two things. Again, one is more fundamental to the process, and one is a more in the practical application. Chazal give us a certain understanding of how we come to be nichshol in arayis. Now, what Chazal are explaining are as follows. Just like when a person catches disease, so one thing we want to look at is what caused the disease, like the bacteria, the virus, etc. And the second question is, why did the immune system fail the person? People have immune systems, and we need to ask ourselves, why was it helpless? Now, Chazal tell us about arayis. Ein adam chote, ela imke nichnas beruach shtus. So when you have something that is arayis, seichel, if a person would be in his full cognizance, he would say to himself, this is terrible, this is crazy, how can I do it? So there's a ruach shtus that comes into the person, and it becomes his ruach. So sometimes you see a teenager. You'll see a teenager who's not stupid, who knows that this is wrong to do and so on, and yet he'll do something crazy. And you say it's like a mishagas got into him. Now, yes, that allows for an aveira to happen. The flip side of it is that he knows when he's doing it that it's wrong, and when the excitement evaporates, whether it's a teenager doing something reckless or crazy, or a person being nechshol arayis, a person has deep regrets, feels very bad about it, and, you know, he might get sucked into it because he has the pleasure that keeps on pushing him, but at the end of the day, he never loses his seichel and his das. That is the mechanism that allows for arayis to happen. And that's why the Rambam says, for instance, when he speaks about prevention of arayis, he speaks about schok and kalos rosh, margilas adam, brings the Mishnah, And these are mechanisms that infuse a person with a Ruach Shabbos. That is one mechanism for Aveira, and that's how Arayis is able to happen. For Gzela, we have a whole different way in which we manage to work our way around the seichel and dasa person. The pasuk says, "Ki ashochad ya'ave eni pikhim." Shochad distorts the vision of a pikeach, and therefore, what happens is the person begins. It's not as if there's two parts of him, and his seichel says this is crazy, and the Ruach Shtus says this is exciting. But it's the very core of the person's seichel begins to bend and to twist and to see things in a very different way. The Maral speaks about Kasheichad Yaveini Pikhim. He says, why is the Einish that the person become blind? So he says, because that's the process that he initiated in his own neshama. What he did was he took the koach hari'iyah and twisted it. So just like when somebody becomes blind, chas v'shalom, there can be a blindness because the mechanism of the eye has a problem. You have a cataract that clouds the vision or the retina, etc., etc. And sometimes, I know somebody born from you know, Mibet Beleda, she's blind. And the problem, the mechanism of the eye is perfect. The mechanism of the brain, which interprets what the eye is seeing, it doesn't work, whatever it is. So a person takes the mechanism that allows sight, and by playing around with it to see things differently, the person is now incapable of seeing. So the Maral says that what the person did was he blinded himself, and therefore there's a physical einish that fits it. It's more than he did something wrong. Chazal say that the iser of taking shochad is even when you take it to paskin like the party that's right. So l'mashal, Reuven and Shimon come to you to din Torah, and they hear the tainus. I've heard the tainus, and I've seen the evidence, and it's clear that Reuven's right. And Reuven slips me money. So I'd say to myself, you know what? Reuven is right, and he's willing to pay for it. So it's a win-win situation. He's going to win, the Torah deserves to win, and I'll get paid fairly for it. So that's called shochat. Even to paskin like the side that's tzaddik, you can't, and that's isa shechat. Because shechat turns a situation into you. It twists the brain so that the brain looks at facts the way it wants them to be. That is the Isser of Sheikhat. So b'meila, the Sheikhat, the mechanism through which Shochat, through the method through which Shochat affects a person and so to speak negates the Yetzer Tov, is not by introducing a foreign element into the person, but rather destroying the person's own tov. It's, if we can use a mashal, one of the reasons why the AIDS virus was so terrible was because it was able to sabotage the person's own antibodies, and the cells that were supposed to defend you became agents of the disease. So Eina Doma, when you have a foreign disease that comes into you and it fights, it can overwhelm you and damage you. But when you have something that subverts your own immune system, then you are devastated. It's gone. So in the world of mominess, it is something that is the mechanism that allows a person's defenses to go down is not an outside force that overwhelms the defenses, but it's a corruption of defense itself. Meaning that if a person takes shochat, he's destroyed something in himself that he can't use for any other time either. He begins to see things differently. Rabbi Pogomansky was one of the giants of in the literature yeshiva world pre-war. He was, tells us, Slabotka, he was a goyin olam, extraordinary figure. He wasn't married till after the war, for a very short time. He was nifta. And he used to say, he was also a very big bal musa. He actually was also bal tshuva, by the way. He was not frum till he was about 20, which was, and he became frum. He was a goyin olam. And he was one of the great figures in Shavuot. My father, if I remember, and anyone who learned and tells Slabotka knows the name of Pogomansky. And he used to say, "Kasherchad ye'avei nepikchim." He says it doesn't speak about that particular case. He says you become blind for life, and he would say it in a very picturesque way. From now on, when you walk in the street, you will step on a baby because your vision has become so distorted you don't see what's going on around you. That is that mechanism. I'd like to add a point of Hesber to why it's like that. The Goyen says in Mishlei, he speaks that there are two fundamental drives for that are for bad in a person, or potentially. One is called koach ha-ta'avoni, which means physical pleasure, physical drives. And then there's koach ha-ka'asoni, which we would associate with ambition, desire to manifest self, to realize self, things along those nature. One of them gives birth to all of physical averis. So the koach of tavani is the koach of food, drink, women, etc., anything that gives a person physical pleasure. Koach ha-ka'asani is all the midas like kas, kina, sinna. It's where your ego and self don't either want to extend themselves, want to realize themselves, something along those lines. So the Goyen says Mishlei has two constant women that try to lead people astray. There is the woman who is Nachriya, which would translate to be a Goyish woman, and there is the Isha Zara, someone else's wife. So the Goyen says, a Koyach of Taiva is Nachri to Klal Yisrael. The Be'etzim should not have any Shaykhs. She's an outsider. Physical pleasures are not the Atzmis of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, in a certain sense, he says, a person who is indulgent is furthest away from the core value of Klal Yisrael. The Isha Zara, the Koach Kasani, the Goyen says, that is really the Koach that Ruchnius rests on. Who are you? Don't you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created to live. Don't you want to live? Don't you want to be? Mr. Shalom speaks about how a person in this world has a problem when he's not chashiv enough. How about in the world to come? The desire to realize self and to make yourself a gavra rabba in whatever musig you're talking about is core to Klal Yisrael also. The question is, what realization? What ambition? What does it mean to be great? Chashav and so on. So the Goyen says, physical craving is totally alien to Klal Yisrael's mitzias. There's nothing good about it as such, and therefore it's just like he says, a woman who's not Jewish, there's no way to marry her. She's not shayach to you. It's of a different world, of a different kind. The kasoni, the woman who is someone else's wife, she could be your wife, she could have been your wife, but right now it's someone else's. So in the kochos hanefesh of greed, ego, realization, there's a place where that's real. A person should say to himself, forever and ever, I'm going to be a nobody. The wanting to be something, realizing yourself, is a core value. But if realizing yourself is driving a fancy car, or having people say, wow, you know, Yehi HaMelech, then we have a problem with it. The desire, the reason why Ruach Shtus is alien, like we described it, it's a different force that comes into a person, and it's outside, it remains an outsider, and when things settle down, you will never mistake it for yourself. A person who's addicted will never mistake, he will kill or die to get what he needs, but he'll never mistake that drink is who he is or drugs is who he is. On the other hand, a person whose money is very much at the heart of a person's sense of self. You know, occasionally a person will steal something because he needs a particular dollar. Most of the time, it's a sense of success. It's a sense of measuring ourselves, of who we are, what we are. We rate things by how much they're worth, and therefore it touches very strongly on kochos hanefesh in a person, that our self, and therefore when I learn to look at it wrong, I distort something in a core of self. So one reason why we're going to have a very hard time dealing with, when a person, for instance, decides to he just stray for food or any other temptation, and he says no, afterwards he feels good. I missed out a pleasure I could have had. But when a person resists a good deal, it's a lot more than that. A person is sacrificing a piece of self. Okay, so I'm just another loser, another, you know, one of those many people sign kind of not very important, nameless, running around, you know, kind of just doing nothing really. And that's a hard one. Success of in a financial area is very much aligned with a person's sense of self. And that's why it becomes so difficult. So A, the drive is a very internal drive that can't be gotten rid of. Two, the effect that it has on the person is, I need, in order to be able to do the avera, I need to play around with it, and so to speak, distort it, and that's how I get around it. So the first reason why this, the nisoyan of honesty, is so difficult, is because we're not talking about an external craving or temptation. We're talking about something on a very deep level, comes from who a person is, mitzad tov, who a person should be, self-realization. And that, therefore, it's so difficult with. And the mechanism that we utilize to cope with our understanding of right and wrong becomes permanent damage to a person's sense of right and wrong. That's one point I wanted to touch on, which I think is a fundamental point as to why it takes a lot more work to deal with it than it does to stay away from physical temptations. I want to mention another area, but another point which I think is a lot more practical. The practical meaning in the sense of it deals with the practical aspect of it rather than the inner underpinnings. We have a very hard time living with ideas and concepts and translating it into reality. You know, we think with pictures, we think with things, and we need models to emulate. So, for instance, tray for food is something that is physical. It's there. We know what it looks like. We've been taught since we're children, this is treif, this heksher is not good, this is good, and so on and so forth. So the picture, the physical picture of something kosher, not kosher, is very, very strongly ingrained in us as a picture. It has very sharp parameters. This is kosher, this is not kosher, this is fleishik, this is milchik, this is machlik, this is shitas, this is stamchol, this is that. We have a very clear sense of it graphically. And therefore, we don't have to use our mind so much. If we stop by a store and we wonder if we can eat or not, we take a look at the Tudah, we think of what people said about the store, and the answer is yes or no. In a certain sense, it's easy because we've always been taught that in real life examples. A person knows about arayas. He knows what is usser, what's wrong, and the question is yes or no. But defining arayas is easy. And it's something the person knows, and especially because it's always been fleshed out. It's always been said this and this and this. We now go to a world that is very, very different. Choshen Mishpat in general is very difficult because it's very hard to flesh it out. The cases you talk about in the Gemara have very, very little resemblance to the final halacha. A person can learn in yeshiva Baba Metzion, Baba Basra, Baba Kama, and he never formulated a picture of it in real life. It does not translate in any picture regarding business practice. So telling people something, not telling them, misleading a little bit, giving an impression, is zero. None of that. There are cases of Ono on the Gemara. There is a perek. Most yeshivas don't get to it. They're Bar Metzia there in the beginning, or Shoal, or, you know, it's not. But okay, there are sugyas. But again, the cases and the examples are far removed from the cases and examples you'll meet in day to day life. So, do we have any image in our mind of what's unethical, what's outright gzela, what's Ono? We don't. We have maybe an image of a Gemara, a true case, and nothing over here. Treifs is a little kid. It's the same piece of candy, same piece of chalk, same heksha. So is this heksha good or not? Has been the same thing from when you're 5 or 50. That's the same. It's basically the same thing. But over here, we have nothing like it. So we're all of a sudden cast into the world where we have to start thinking and asking ourselves, yes, no, is it such a shaila? Nothing in our mind that's built up over the years saying, no, this is terrible, this is bad. And every case is very different. You have some cases that are fine in Choshen Mishpat, some cases that are over the red line, and some cases that are really bad. And we almost have, even if we ask a shayla once, twice, three times, we have a very, very hard time applying it the fourth and fifth and sixth time. That's why a dayan is a very chashev position, and two, no two dayanim may even tell you the same thing in the same case. It varies in so many factors that case by case, whatever dayan paskins, that's what you go by. So we have a real hard time with being able to do something with it, because you don't have those physical models. That's one area that is deficient in our upbringing. Now, It's very difficult to create situations where we could teach it. But I'm just saying, it's a mitzias, is we have nothing, that we walk into a world where we are totally immersed in Choshen Mishpat, and we have no previous graphic models of things that are treif, and things that are kosher, and things that are chatchil, and things that are yevet. A second area, and it's... A child grows up, most of what inspires us and gives us and gives us models are stories that were taught in yeshiva. It's not pleasant to say, but the stories probably occupy much bigger part in their spiritual life than do the actual teachings. That's par for the course. It's always been like that. So if we ask ourselves, the stories that we tell our children, what are those stories about? I'm talking about the stories, chinuch stories. So if you're chassidish, a lot of maifsim, and with a message that rebbes can do many, many nisim and flaws and maifsim, admittedly, my personal stories were short on that count, and okay. Hasmada learning, the Vilna Gaon, how many hours learned during the day, and Reb Zalmala, and so on and so forth. There's nefesh from mitzvahs, the Iduka mitzvahs, where the stories like that. You will get stories about Chesed and Avos Yisrael. Those are all stories that are part of our lore, a part of our Masorah, of what we teach our children. I don't know where the Olam's from. I don't know where everybody learned and came from and what and so on. But I would like to ask, myself included, how many stories do we tell our children about people who had temptations to do wrong in Choshen Mishpat and in Mominus, and yet overrode their temptations? I wonder. I would challenge people to go through the storybooks and to find them. How many stories are there of people who existed and still were Matzliach? And how many stories are there of people who didn't but felt good about themselves, did honestly? I want to share a story that made an impression on me as a grown-up. I had a cousin, Zechon Evracha. His name was Yisrael Ganz. His father was the Yibad HaChaim Torah Meruchim, was a Mashgiach in Shalabim, and very special person, very, very special person. His son was born with, I think, like cerebral palsy or something. I don't know exactly what it was, but limped. He had certain physical handicaps from birth. He never allowed that to stop him, never wanted to take the easy way out. Whatever everybody else had to do, I have to do. That was the person. He was 19 years old and ran to get a bus to go to yeshiva, was killed. And at his hesped, a rebbe of his said the following story. He said, He was taking a test in yeshiva, and the rebbe walked by and he saw there was a question, like a multiple part question, that was blank. So he said, "Yisrael, why don't you fill it in?" He says, "Doesn't know." So he said, "But it's like a 6-part question. You can probably try a few parts, and you're sure you get like 2, 3, 4 right. You get partial credit." So he said in Hebrew, obviously, he told the rebbe, he says, "Ani lo chafif. I don't drain a cup. If I know it, I know it. If I don't know it, I don't know it." How many stories like that have we exposed our kids? How many times have we told our kid, you know, the grade may have not been glamorous, but it was honest. You worked hard, you did what you could, and more than anything else, that's important. How many times? I want to tell you a story that one of my Talmidim, and gave me tremendous nachas. There was a Talmud Rasi in Shiva many years ago. I wouldn't say he was the biggest masbid in yeshiva. He was, let's call him Lebedik. geschmack, enjoyable, you know, but not the person you would associate with Chavetz Chaim stories of extraordinary tzidkis. He was a geschmack, a guy, defined, but that was him. He went to work. He was single still. He was dirt poor. His father was a chinuch, is a chinuch all his life, and basically he was very poor. And he went to work as some sort of company that sold stuff on the internet, and was doing, you know, he had parnos, he was able to help his parents actually. And he calls me up one day and he says, Rebbe, I have a problem. I think that what they're doing here is dishonest. And he described it to me, and it was borderline zela. And I was trying desperately to find some heta because I knew how poor he is. I didn't know if he had money for the next day to live on. You know, he was dirt poor. I knew he was helping his parents, and I was trying to figure out what is his role in this. Is he misagay? And I kept probing. I said, so who says this and who does this? And after the third or fourth question, he says, Rebbe, if this is not yashar, I'm out. I'm not looking to be a ganav with a heter. And he walked off his job. He found another job later that night, actually. But I don't want to make this into a Mephis story. I really said to myself, here's somebody. I was really astounded. I was here's somebody who, you know, it didn't come out of it came out of a very solid sense of, if it's wrong, it's wrong. I was trying to figure out how exactly do we do it? It's tough for many reasons, and I think it's Baruch Hashem, it's a challenge because there's much opportunity, and wherever there's much opportunity, there's also much issues. But being able to find in the big picture, one would suggest speaking about halachas in a way that in halachas and mishpat in a way that is real, true to life. We need to be able, just like with candies and with cookies, we're able to say if it has this OU, OB, OC, whatever it is, if it has that, then that's kosher. If it's not, it's not kosher, and so on and so forth. We have a very clear and vivid impression of what it is that's us and muta. We have to find a way to do it with chosh mishpat, to give cases that are real life. It takes people who can give those cases, and also people who can translate into halacha what you can, what you can't do. Every business is trying to sell something, and yet, what are the parameters of making something attractive? Not telling people yes, whatever they are, finding ways to learn halacha lemaisa of the parts of chosh mishpat that are relevant to what goes on in day-to-day commerce. That's what we live. Secondly, being able to find and emphasize those stories that bring out this part of it. It's just like a Rebbe who feels that his classroom is weak in tefillah is going to find stories that inspire tefillah. A Rebbe that feels his classroom is weak in Talmud Torah is going to find stories. It's true that while a child is in yeshiva, so the chosh mishpat issues are relatively limited. You know, it is not dealing in so many things. But when they become relevant, it's going to be past the story stage of chinuch. Those stories of people with, you know, ironclad honesty and clear sense of mine and his and so on, it'll be late. There's no picture of that. So those are things I would suggest. And again, this is no one person going to do it, but I think if we think about it enough and consider it enough, it will be helpful. So if we're going back to our original question, our Dora struggles a lot with this because we have so much opportunity and such a need to be successful by measures of where we are financially, it's a nisayon. We can't get away from that. We need not just fiery drushes about how terrible Gzela is, because I'm not sure that exactly is the problem. I mean, I think most people understand it's bad. And when they open up a newspaper and there's another picture and another story, you know, it makes us cringe. So I don't think that's the area. I think, A, understanding the inner mechanism, if we value ourselves by this, we are going to get into it very quickly. And the minute we learn to fudge clear lines of emes and sheker, it stays as permanent damage. When a person is nichshel in avera of craving, it may stay as a need for more pleasure, but he's never distorted really inside. He knows he's wrong and terribly wrong. But when you distort those lines of right and wrong in the world of mammonis, you permanently cripple yourself. And you hear sometimes people say things, you say, they can't believe it. They can't really think that this is okay. And sometimes you just see they've gotten so used to twisting things that this is, you know, at some point it just remains twisted. And I think building those paradigms of right and wrong much more graphically than we do today. Understanding if this is an issue, we have to start early. It means creating halachic works and teachings that speak about real life situations. It's tricky. A child may not understand business dealings. Yeah, it will require a lot of thinking of how to translate it into cases that a child can understand. And secondly, being able to find those stories of Gdol Yisrael and Pasha people that stood strong with it. If you learn to build a model of a hero who this was his gevura, then I think it will give paradigms for children to follow. Those are two areas that I think may be of help as Hashem. The Rosh Karlo spoke about questions and answers or whatever it is, so if there's any questions, answers, or whatever, I mean, yes?
Is there an issue in also we have a hard time relating to the rules necessarily? I mean, the rules we've kind of grown up with are different rules, and all of a sudden are...
For instance, give me some example. I'm not sure. I'm sorry, what?
Oh, our definition was legal and illegal, so you go to the business world, it's different than we go to the business world.
Thank you very much. That also, it might be a point to, I mean, the Gemara speaks about you can't give a child, you can't give him a rimon instead of an esrig, because the asur lemisrach, he, you know, when he becomes an adult, that picture will stay with him. That was okay. It might be a lot of thought about what you want to condone in behavior if this becomes a permanent part of it. And the fact that, you know, the way things were done, when you teach a child to bend the rule, even if that case, the rule was stupid, but once he loses, you know, that things are made to be gotten around, then you create a problem. And you need to think, you need to ask yourself twice if this is right or not. It's a good point. Yes?
About a couple of years ago, there was an individual who was sentenced to federal prison for financial crimes. And his release from prison was widely celebrated. In the front community. A rabbi in this town objected, saying that his release should not have been celebrated in such a public manner by the community, because what he did was, in essence, a terrific chilul Hashem. And that rabbi was roundly criticized by other elements of the community. it would seem, how does the Rosh Yeshiva explain in such a case, and there have been others, why is there not more widespread communal condemnation of these actions and a, something like a call for, just like there was an internet asifa, perhaps there should be a call for a business asifa?
So, actually, on the second part, there was... I know Aguda had for a few years business asifa. They were called Dina Malchus asifas. And I actually listened to recordings of it. I was in New York. They were actually quite, they were very good, the lectures. I think, generally speaking, whenever it comes to big affairs, there's usually a swirl of different reasons why something happens a certain way. I don't know all the details of that case, and I've learned over years that when you're not directly involved, you usually hear bits and pieces. But you know, in every case, there's a sympathy for a particular person. There may have been reasons why certain things were done. There may have been reasons. The celebration there's a problem with the public way it was celebrated. I'm still from the old school with thinking very clearly about what do other people think about this. So yes, you have a particular take on it. Even if it's right, what do other people think about it? My father was still in a country where people actively persecuted, so Bemele, you're very sensitive to it. I wondered about that. I'm also the problem is on a public level, it's hard to give nuanced understandings. On the one hand, a person might have been a very good person, a very positive person. A person might have done a lot for people. A person may have been given a tremendous dose of suffering, maybe far beyond. On the other hand, a person did do something that wasn't right, At some point, personally, anything that happens in a public arena is overdone in either direction. I do think just because somebody has done something, has been sentenced, there's another part to it. You can resonate with a person's personal geula and yet understand that there are big parts of it that need to be, but that was wrong, and so on. Once something becomes public, it becomes an extraordinary distortion to one side to another. I'm not a player, but on a personal level, just help us. I do think people need to bear in mind that person is a very positive person who really helped a lot of people, person who cared about people. What was leveled on the person was extraordinary by all accounts. The suffering that was, there was a hatzalah. On the other hand, there was wrong, and being able to balance those two feelings is hard enough for a person to nuance them. But on the publicity level, it's like the newspaper needs to write either a story about a hero or a villain. There are no people that are mixed. I don't know what it's the problem. Anything that becomes public, it becomes distorted in any of your direction. Yes?
You've mentioned a couple of times you said it creates permanent damage.
Yeah.
When you start blending or blurring the lines between truth and, maybe bending.
Yes.
It's not already delivered. What practical advice do you have for some of us who may have stumbled and fell flat and made those mistakes?
I once heard from Yaakov Weinberg, and he, when a person learns Gemara, when a person is learning Be'iyun, and a person asks himself honestly, so what should be the halacha here? So what's the din there? You retrain your mind. I mean, the first thing that a person can recognize it means that he hasn't been, that there's still something there that's very sensitive to truth. That in itself is extremely admirable that a person is still holding there. I mean, you see people will hold by two things that are absolutely contradictory, except the common denominator is both in his favor. You'll see people pushing for things that are in their favor, and then and you know, taking two contradictory sides of something. I think understanding that, and then the learning itself, if a person learns honestly, the core of Talmud Torah, like Gemara, is a search for the truth. So is this what it means? Is it not what it means? So how does it translate this pshat? So I think that Torah is meant to train a person and to get him to understand emes. And Bez Hashem. But I'm saying the fact that a person can look back and say, you know, I've been playing around too much, I think is an extraordinary statement of a person. Yeah? Yes?
Maybe to tie the first two questions a little bit, be more practical. I understand that, you know, when you talk about stories, I agree with you. But one story that I always remember was the story about the Jews in Russia. There was a tax between Jews in Turkey and Jews in Russia for tobacco. And there was a big rob, and he ran around Pesach. He couldn't find any chumas, but he could find everybody just smuggling.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, that was a story where Jews in history, especially in modern, the last 500 years, the government was sort of the enemy.
Yes.
And the Jews had special taxes. They were always being persecuted. They would make too much money. They'd be kicked out of England. So we built this mentality that it was okay to deceive or disrupt the government, which I think ultimately then can, by what you're saying now, go over. So it seems even within Chasam Mishpat, there seems to be a dual honesty level between the Jews and non-Jews. And I think today's world, that can be very dangerous, especially now that we have Israel, maybe even more clouded because now you have a technically Jewish government, or whatever that means, right? So I think, you know, this idea of the stories, the double standards, a lot of it stems from it's okay to do something to a certain group of people, not necessarily good for other people, and then it becomes clouded in the way you just do business in general. Any comments?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, let's not go back. I mean, my parents lived in New York. They were older people, they were survivors. So the script of life was basically that you could not, it was impossible to live without lying because that was the reality there. I had a daughter and son-in-law who lived in Russia for quite a few years. They had a yeshiva, or some of you might know, Kiva Yosevich, Olyakov. And everything worked with bribery. I don't know the Russian olim here. I mean, that was what life was built on. It was a reality. It was an unfortunate reality. And there's a pasuk that says, "Innovati tavavim ikesh sispatol," that with a straight person, you deal honestly. With a crook, you have to go round and about. For instance, if somebody's holding a gun to your head, if you can lie to him and get out, then you have to do that. Life in Europe, I mean, I read that in Russia today, if you want to pay taxes by the book, you owe more than you earn. And that's why basically what it does is make everybody into a thief. And that's why it's a horrible society, because, you know, it's a society where there are no rules and everyone knows it's just a game. So basically you're back to an anarchy. But what we do have to, Baruch Hashem, we live in a society. Yes, it's not perfect, and it's not. But at the end of the day, it functions as a reasonably civilized society, and we need to consciously break away from it. You know, people that identify themselves more as American have an easier time with it. Other people still live like that. Yes, it's true. That's where a lot of it came from. But we have no choice, because what will happen is, we'll never be able to build a decent society. If everything is underhand, then you have no society. There are no countries run like that that have healthy economies and societies, because it's basically a mass anarchy. We need to teach our children whatever was, and in those situations, you know, if you cheated a Nazi, if you told him you're not Jewish, that you weren't committing a crime, you know, if you got hold of a potato, and ate it and saved life in Siberia, that was not stealing. That was doing what was right. But Baruch Hashem, we don't live like that today. And we need to re-educate ourselves and our children. We have no choice. You're right as far as the background is, but tachlis, there's a world. Yes?
The thought has been floated that to the extent that people live amongst a foreign nation, so like the Rosh Hashanah is saying about building a society, so to a certain extent that a person doesn't feel like a member of that society in full, and that this is the society I'm looking to build, so then there's not that same feeling of obligation to that society.
Well, there's a big difference between obligation to negation. In other words, we appropriately don't feel ourselves as American at the core of ourselves. We're Klal Yisrael. But not feeling American has nothing to do with not acting honestly. And acting honestly has to do with being Klal Yisrael. And the fact that you don't feel that your life's accomplishment is helping build America, and you feel as a guest in America, you know, when I'm in somebody's house, I'm a guest, I still can't take the silverware. Even if I'm not interested, I have no interest in this family becoming wealthy, but taking their silverware is not recommended. It's not a very, very...
So just the shadow, could this be a contributing factor?
It could be. We also had, you know... It's interesting. We didn't have in Europe. It was in Eastern Europe. The people around you weren't barbarians, and the question was how to deal with it. I can't sit in modern America and say how people should have dealt with them, because they weren't. And it would be naive of me to think. But one thing I can say is there's no justification for it over here. You know, it's I can understand why we got to where we got to. But that doesn't become an excuse. An explanation is not an excuse. Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to switch a little bit to business. I've seen all the good Israel conventions at Baruch Torah, never spoke about it, and I left a message on the first night that I moved here to Chicago. Yeah, about its kind of heritage. An adventure for Shmuel Kamenetsky came in. I didn't have a chance of speaking about that, but however, they wrote a child, gave a speech there, and didn't have a chance to speak to him, so I left the message. I've been in through the Shiva system, and I left DMG 10 years ago. And I've seen like so much, you know, I've seen a lot where, you know, former Shiva light, and both, you know, from the working field have, you know, yelled at workers, being Mavazdin, Barabin, right before Yom Kippur, the Mexican put two things in the bag. And he's a manager, it's this out, screaming at him, why pay 10 cents for each bag? And he agrees, it's this out, he's the prominent manager, you know, like what I've seen in many places happen to me, I've known others where. Plus, I don't understand. I assume that a person could. A boss could come into a business and fire a worker just for no reason. However, especially as, you know, Jewish from people, you know, Rachmanim, near Rachmanim, to fire somebody without pulling up a rug. And I think in America, where Shmuel Kamenetsky is very much, I think, that the biggest one to ask, if it's a Shiloh to start throwing the Jew off the streets, not having a baby, not having, you know, pampers to wear or paying rent or something like that, or to scream at a Yeltsin that they stole, which wasn't really his fault, but fire him. Like, I've seen this over and over, and, you know, I don't think it was ever spoken about how if a worker needs to be reprimanded. So I would say every Friday, what would happen? Take him to the office and give him, I'm not ashamed, but scream at it and this and that. And, you know, I've seen it all over, and I've never seen it spoken about.
Well, I did write about it in the book, you know. So yes, as you said, this is a very wonderful segue to advertise. But I didn't come. Oh, I didn't. What? I don't want to mix business with pleasure. So the answer is yes. It's like everything. Every time there's a tzibra has a challenge, it takes people to keep pushing the agenda. It's, you know, what happens is people work with inertia. I, you know, in my life, I've seen many positive changes in Klal Yisrael, and it always took anything. People are have a comfort level of doing what they're used to doing. If it would be spoken about more and pushed more and so on and so forth, the answer is yes. The problem is, like, you mentioned a whole bunch of things that are all upsetting. You'd have to learn how to quantify and explain, you know, these different behaviors. Like I said before, you need concrete models. The common denominator is they're all extremely upsetting and you know, and but you need more concrete models. That's one issue. I also would take an issue with something that you said about asking Rav Shlomo Kamenetsky. There's a tendency today that every problem goes to the God Lador. It's a real problem, because what happens is you're asking a shaila to somebody who may not have the time to hear it totally, who doesn't know you, doesn't know the people involved. Do we not have anybody but one person in America, one person in Israel? I mean, the Torah, the Akdamah to Torah is, sorry, I love him, sorry, Meir, sorry, this, sorry, that. I will speak about this. There's something, there was an advertisement, there's an advertisement that appears in the Modia on a regular basis. I forgive them the Parnassah of the Modia, and it's a wonderful thing that they have Parnassah. But it goes like this. I asked Reb Chaim Kanievsky what to do about all the tzaras in America, and he answered, in Xaviat Kotche, they should say Yom Kippur Cotton. Now, who is this person who went to ask Reb Chaim Kanievsky? He doesn't have a Rav, there's no Rabban in the city. They're the ones that ask the question. My father's Zechayin Avracha grew up in Kovna. Kovna was the Ir Ve'en Yisrael. It was a very, very strong, it was a big Jewish community. The Dvar Avram was Kovna Rav. The Dvar Avram was a very big Talmud Chacham. He was a Nichbad B'Yosef. When he would walk in the street, the Goyim would stand at attention. He was a very intelligent person. There was no way that a person in community could ask him a Shaila. The Rabbanim sat with him every whatever it was and asked the Shailas. Every person has a Rav, should have a Rav. Going straight there is not an Eitzah. And that's why I would like to think that the person should ask a Shaila. That's correct. But this habit of everybody asking it doesn't produce great things. It has so many downsides to it that I think it's one of the problems. Yes.
You kind of touched on this, but how does one, you know, one of the greatest, you know, things that you have is the ability to rationalize.
Yeah.
And so,
tell me what?
You know, how do you, you know, keep yourself, you know, levels where, you know, we can rationalize away anything. And you also can't, you know, on the flip side, you can't call a rub every 10 minutes, right? How much should I owe the Mexican guy? What about the drink? How do you, you know, keep yourself straight with kind of posturing for yourself throughout the day, especially when it comes to Dina Mamanos, and keep yourself honest that way?
You know, the first thing is, if a person at least has a list of things that he had a suffix about, a person has, you know, it can't be that you run every 10 minutes, but you accumulate over some time things that you felt you're not sure if you did right or not. And at least if you're open enough and willing to ask about it, then that itself is something that will allow you to correct yourself. You know, and usually these things are patterns. So if you find yourself doing this again and again, so ask, sit down and ask somebody who is, you know, who's your Rav, and get a feel for it. Yeah. Okay.
Nobody's asking, I'll ask a second question, but somebody has a... I want to just tie into this thing, because the Spucker magazine wrote a, I thought, a great piece about a month ago about Joel Wasserman, who's a former professor at Harvard Business School now at USC, and he talks a lot about best practices. So if you really try to build a great business practice, you don't yell at your employees. This is not a great culture you build. You want to build a great culture at a leading company, right? So I think what we lack a little bit, except for certain people, is people that really understand how to build in the business world, because a lot of it, doing the right thing actually is the most profitable thing as well. Build, you know, that's just the way it is, right? But either people have knowledge of the Kashmir Mishpat, come out of the yeshiva world, and get into business, don't always have the knowledge of building great organizations like that. But on the secular side, you have people who know a lot about building great business but don't understand the nuances of the Jewish world. And I think ultimately it would be great to sort of mesh the two sides, because in the reality of it, you don't fire people without a just cause. It's not a good business practice. Forgetting about what the halakha is about Jews and having food for Pampers, it's just not. Employees don't want to work in fear every day that they're not going to lose their job for no reason, or because your brother-in-law needs a job and you're going to fire this guy and hire your brother-in-law. It's not a good way to build a great organization, right? So I think there is a measure where you can actually meld these two things together and actually make more money and do the right thing at the same time, right?
Fine. The problem is what happens, two things. So if somebody sits and lectures to me how to build a great corporation, okay, but I have a deli and I have a worker who has to do 100 deliveries out of Shabbos. So, in other words, I'm not building a big corporation, and if I squeeze the person more for more work and this and that, I seem to be gaining. There's another part to it where a person needs to understand is it right or is it wrong? And the Rambam, such a powerful Rambam. The Rambam says, even though technically a person can insult an Eved Knaini, the Rambam says a Jew is a Rachman. And he says, and it's a Midas Achzorius. So it has nothing to do with the Eved, it has to do with you. And the Rambam says, and he says, it's one of those powerful arguments. He says, we stand in front of Rabbi Yisraelam and we say, you know, Ke'ene Shifchal Gevirta, Ke'ene Eved Al Adonov. We're looking at you like an Eved is looking to his Adon for mercy. And HaKadosh Baruch says, yeah, and so I'll treat you the way you treat your Eved. Or your Gevirta. It's one of those powerful arguments. It's good if you can add the sweetener that at the end of the day this is good business practice. But it's an additive. It's like the people who explain that kosher food is healthier for you. It's helpful maybe, but sometimes there'll be a conflict. To make that case about Cholent is not an easy case to, you know.
You have the story. You remember the story moving Purity in Boston?
Yes.
I mean, there's a great story, right?
That's a very good story.
His plant burned down right before Christmas, and he paid all his.
I want to say that okay? Correct. That's
and
a good story.
I don't know if that's Chesha Mishpat didn't necessarily require it.
It's the way a Yid should act, but it has nothing. And I don't know how his business went afterwards. I think just. Stressing the moral component is very important. It's helpful sometimes, like it says, you know, it's a her if you say in the end of the day the business also proves. But as Yidden, I think the emphasis should be on that. Yes?
In my experience, you know, in finance and business world and sales and whatnot, the Rosh Shiva mentioned that, you know, there's many kinds of gray area.
Yeah.
And it's a very difficult area to navigate. So the example that I see, and I think a lot of other working people see, is, you know, there's a lot of conflict of interest in business.
Right.
And how to navigate that. For example, the company is saying sell service product X, Y, Z, and you realize the client, probably the best thing for the client is X, and the company say you need to sell Y. You don't sell Y, your job is on Y. And it's not bad for the client, but X is better. And you're constantly in a situation where you feel, and your conscience is saying, X is better, X will pay me more, X will pay the company more, but Y is probably the better choice for the client. And you're always, you know, and you're saying, well, I should do the good thing and sell Y, but then you'll get reprimanded. But if I sell X, it's constantly paying more and need this, and you're constantly in that cycle, and you're constantly trapped. So you're either underperforming or you're not doing what the company wants, but you're not doing, and it's almost avoidable. So how do you navigate this? Like what you know? I know it's a very specific question, but it's a kind of constant in the business world, and especially in sales. Is it wrong to sell? Is it better to listen to clients,
the
company?
So, okay. I don't want to pass the shiloh here. It's not the right setting, not the right... but this is a very, very important halacha. It's a very important shiloh. It falls under lifnei iver. It falls under being, you know, Yatsnura, it falls under many other categories. You need to sit down, ask a shayla, with somebody who understands the fields. You need to know, is this something that this is where you should draw your parnasa from, if there's no way around it? It depends, are you pushing it as one of many different options with advantages that it does have? So even though the big picture is, if he were to make a cheshbon and take everything into cheshbon, maybe something else would be better for him. But as long as your presentation is okay, you're telling him, you know, the miles of your product, without not lying about it. That's a different story. It really depends on the details, and you know, it may be that it's something that a person should stay away from. Yes, it's unfortunate. I know this is very true about different health insurance plans and things of that nature, where people are buying something they really don't need and it's not an advantage for them. So in the big picture, it depends a lot about what your role is. Are you leading somebody, or are you emphasizing what's good about the plan? And you know, and so on. But you know, your person needs to think twice. Even if halachically will say that it's okay, do I want to spend my life really to the detriment of people that I'm serving? You know, at the end of the day, it's something that you need to sit down with the details with somebody that you see as your Rebbe Rav and go through it. And I understand, Shiloh, it's a very tough Shiloh. Yes?
And then touching on what Ami was saying as well in a different way, I feel like one of the biggest challenges in the business world, especially in a secular business world, is that everyone needs to be very laid back and very casual about things. And that automatically right then and there is sucking people in to drop their guard. And there really has to be a proper balance in terms of, okay, how much do I want to play the game, so to speak, in terms of just being very laid back, be able to schmooze with people. Schmoozing can get so casual sometimes that you're no longer acting the way that you feel like is appropriate to act, but that's the way that people are doing things. That's the way that it's expected to be able to act in that role, especially in more of a management role, because you have to be able to interact with just about everybody. So where's that balance? I mean, obviously we want to be able to be thinking properly, but when you're so immersed in that world, it's a little more different, like we're talking about. Much easier to rationalize, but at the same point in time, you do need to be able to interact with just about everybody.
So, on some of the areas, and someone talked before about Professor Wasserman. Professor Wasserman actually has a brother, big Talmud Chacham, Harvard Law School graduate Ari Wasserman, who's written a book, Making It Work, and he's about to put out another book about women and their special issues in the workplace. Well, he touches on a lot of his halachic issues and a lot of his practical issues. I would highly recommend it. He doesn't give psukim. He goes through the different challenges, different approaches people have used, and different approaches as far. It's a very honest and structured work. He's amazing. I guess part of the decision that a person makes before, you know, when he makes the transition from a very insulated yeshiva world to the outside world, is how much do I want to be part of the society? It is natural for a normal person to want to be fully integrated in society around him. And it takes three things, saying, let me see what that line is. I'll never be like them. I will never fit in. if a person wears a yarmulke, which is good, I'll be different. So in New York, a yarmulke is, you know, it's par for the course, so, you know, it doesn't put you... So, but I will be different. And the compensation for it is going to have to be the merit of my work. That's the only thing I can do to make me... They're going to say, you know, this guy's a little bit of an oddball, but doesn't mix well, but he really does amazing work. That's the only way we can compensate for it. But we pay a price for, you know, for the Havdalah Ben Yisrael Amin. We're moved up. We're different. And part of it will have to be... And so certain things like a yarmulke is a thing. So you wear a yarmulke, you wear a yarmulke. How to act so that I don't become one of the guys and yet I'm chilled out enough that I could work with it is and would be very nice if people would have... People who've gone through the workplace have done well and yet have retained our people that are admired to speak about these things. And again, Ari Wasserman writes about a lot of these things. He's been there. He'd been in a law firm. He's in business. And today he mostly sits and learns, and I think he has investments and stuff. But he's been there, and he writes about, and he's collected, especially the book about the women. He actually interviewed dozens and dozens of frum women in the workplace and presents their challenges. And there's a lot of differences of opinion in terms of what challenges were strong, how to get around it, what did they find challenging, you know. But at least it gives a person a sense of it. But you're right, one of those things you're going to have to predetermine and make it clear to yourself is, I will always be an odd man out. There's no choice. There's, you know, and that's why we're different. That's why, you know, we're one of the Havdalahs. We're as different as light and dark. Yes, maybe one more question for someone didn't ask. What? No, and I know there's a myriad of issues, so yeah, well, sorry.
It seems that a lot of the conflict arises from our interaction with the legal system and with the goyim. And although I agree with that we're here as guests more than people, but what is the model, if you maybe can help us model this particular scenario, what is the role which the Jew, and what is the model, the ideal, to which the Jewish Bali Tshuva or a frum person is expected to live up to when interacting with the legal system and the goyim, in as much as it seems to me that some of the justice and some of the evolution of civilization came through our light that we brought to the group.
Right.
So is there, can you help us model, like you said in the story, what is there an expectation?
Well, Bnei Noach are commanded to have a legal system. It is one of the Zionists in Noach. As long as the legal system is reasonable and you know, in halacha, in the big model, a tendency towards being authoritarian is fine, even if it's kind of harsh and strong. But society needs to be held in check. It needs to be ruled. So as long as it's reasonable and fair, you know, as they speak about Dina Malchusa, as long as it's reasonable and fair, it's you living by them obligates you to abide by it. The problem was, like they mentioned before, there was a time when it was not, I mean, reasonable and fair were words that no way could have fit the laws in the good days in Eastern Europe. So, you know, but today, I don't think, you know, with all the complaints and everything, at the end of the day, I cannot imagine any rational person making the argument that it's not, it's not reasonable. So they're supposed to do that. That's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to, halachic, people make a mistake. The halacha, I don't want to go off on it, but the system of mishpat in Klal Yisrael, Choshev Mishpat, is on a much higher madrega because it's not about keeping law and order. It's about emulating HaKadosh Baruch Hu and actually, again, it's late, I'm not going to go with it. We augment, the Ran speaks about this, the Rashbi speaks about this. The ideal situation was Sanhedrin would paskin halacha al pi chosh mishpat. The king was making sure that there are no gaps, that people are getting away with it, and he would enforce authoritarian rule on those things. And this was discussed a little bit when they founded the State of Israel, the pre-founding it that Chaim Ozer wrote about, referenced these halachas. There's a need to fill in with practical laws to keep law and order. So as long as what they're doing can be understood to be that way, we need to go along.
Do you think that some of the evolution of, let's say, American society is far removed from the Mitzrayim? It still has many of the elements, but it's certainly a lot more just, probably, than the Mitzrayim. Do you think that the role of the Jew in the society is to shine some of this light to allow the society to go into learn from a little bit from how things are supposed to be done and which level to aspire to for the going to show them? But
my chinuch, our chinuch has been that yes, we're supposed to shine a light. The way we shine a light is by glowing. In other words, to go around with a flashlight, shining in other people's faces, was not the way to go about it. If an Orthodox Jew acts the way he should, and he's working with non-Jews, and they say, you know, this is a man of his word. This is somebody who doesn't play around, doesn't fool around. It's somebody who's got his strange laws, but he never, ever bends corners with it. That's a light. You know, big shining projectors last very short and don't do much. Somebody recently spoke to me about they want to make this huge, nothing about your type, something else, this huge gathering of proclamations. I said, that stuff is nonsense. You know, it's one by one by one. If a person acts the way he should act, that is a light for nation. And even if two people saw it or three people saw it, but if everybody would act like that, it would have tremendous... If people would say, yeah, if you hire these Jews with the funny, with the cap and this and that, they're kind of strange, but, you know, a word is a word, and an hour of work is an hour of work, and there's something... And never raise their voice, and, you know, they're always civil and so on and so forth. Believe me that would be a tremendous light for the nations. Maybe even for us, you know, that it might even actually... Okay. Seder.
You've just experienced another Torah class brought to you by TorahAnytime.com.